Lucky 13, Lecture 13, October 4th, Lecture Notes, page 106. If you have an interest in sales as sales, whatever your major, it doesn't matter, but you think sales might be in your future, you don't have time for a major or a minor, I don't think we have a major, in sales, boom, the sales, KSU Sales Club is new. They are focusing on doing sales, they're low cost. So if sales is in your future, think about joining the KSU Sales Club. There's the contact information with Sydney. She's really an excellent student. If you're interested in earning honors stuff, honors distinction, they're holding an info session Tuesday, October 10th, over in the Design Innovation Hub, so you can learn more about doing an honors thesis. Looking at that print on that background, they could also do a little design work that's better, but okay. If you're an entrepreneur or have an idea for a business of any kind and you're in early stages, do a pitch. They can hand you money to run with your idea. Many of our successful students started with the idea pitch. You can apply through Friday. I guess at that click on that QR code. So go get yourself some money for your new business idea. We're here Wednesday. If I haven't mentioned it to you, you get Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off, at least for me. Everybody's supposed to give you days off. And so that's fall break. And we will, after today, pick up with Lecture 14 next Monday, as we had planned to do. Midterm 1 closes this evening at 6 p.m. Who hasn't taken the midterm yet? Just curious. Okay, so, you know, if you're here, you aren't taking it. Well, you could be taking it on your computer, I guess, while we're talking. That could happen, yeah. So hopefully you've got that in mind. Web students, you know you're probably seeing me next week. Never mind. All right, so what can we say about the next mini test? Will open next Tuesday after spring break. So wait a second, that's not right. Hold on. It is open. It closes next Tuesday after spring break. So you don't have to worry about doing this if you haven't yet. You still have when you come back Monday and Tuesday to get that done. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit number 4 will close this evening, and number 5 will open after. I keep saying spring break, don't I? Because that's what you used to say, spring break. But you know what I mean, not spring, fall. Because hopefully you aren't here in the spring, unless you don't do well in the fall, in which case you'll be back in the spring. I mean fall break. Fall break. It opens after fall break. So we planned this around fall break. I'm still getting questions on a midterm one exam. Don't know what to say. This stuff's been up a lot. I've sent you email. It's on the website. It's here too. And I'm not going to ask you any questions. If you have any questions, you'll let me know, I guess. The one question I guess I do get is, will there be a curve? Almost always there's a curve. I can't imagine there's not a curve. When will I know the curve? Well, not till at least after this evening when everybody's taken the test. I can't tell you the curve before I know the grades. And what will I do with the curve? I'll try to bring the grades up to 72% average. That'll push some people over 100, at least it always has. And the average will be 72. All right, I'll ask. Any questions on that? Or anything about it? And then I'll use all this to post midterm grades, which are coming due shortly. So how many of you guys remember used Blockbuster? Was that a thing? Okay. And how many of you guys used the old Netflix with the red envelopes? Some of you still remember that with the DVDs coming, yeah? So this was, I think, a cutesy, I guess, story. Blockbuster ads celebrate that they have outlasted Netflix in the DVD business. So they're having fun with this. Blockbuster will take its wins where it can get them, particularly when the opportunity arises to stick it to Netflix, the company that put Blockbuster very nearly, although not quite entirely, out of business. So, quote, competition in the marketplace. There is exactly, anybody know how many Blockbuster stores are left? How many? One, exactly. There's one Blockbuster store, and they're having fun as the remaining brand out there. So you may have heard Netflix shipped its final DVD by mail last Friday, exiting the business that originally put the company on the map 25 years ago, long before the arrival of streaming. This was delightful news to the one remaining Blockbuster store, there used to be 9,000, in Bend, Oregon, which can now say that it outlasted Netflix at something. Blockbuster posted this ad up here, we still have DVDs and humans, on its Instagram account on Friday, and it ended up being its most liked social post ever. So social media and marketing, I forget if this will take me out to that click. Oh, this is a different part of the story. I think we get to here a different way. Let me make it pause for a second and see if I come back to this. So they posted that on their Instagram account. In many ways, it's fitting that Blockbuster is holding on to the DVDs and bucking the trends of the moment, since the company's whole brand positioning now, today, is captured in the broader Till the Bitter End campaign that's about outlasting the inevitable. So this is their brand position. Let me see what this click does for us. Should be that same thing.
Grammarly's five tips for writing a professional email. Email writing is super important.
This is one of their current campaigns.
When the world ends and the internet streams no more, we'll still be here.
So when the world ends, the internet streams no more, just like cockroaches, we'll still be here. Hey Steve, till the bitter end. So they're really playing as a brand image, as a brand perception with this idea. The world's last Blockbuster store became an icon of an era, keeping one of the most iconic brands alive. After years and years of the media repeating that Netflix was responsible for putting Blockbuster out of business, it's funny that Blockbuster just outlasted Netflix on DVDs. This is a gold material for the brand's fans, and we had to react to it. The ad agency is saying that. So here's a brand in that we'll talk later on about the product life cycle of all brands. There's introduction, there's growth, maturity, and as you can imagine right now, these guys are in the last stage, decline stage of the product life cycle, but they're hanging on there. And of course, they are using this to build relations with their fans, consumer relations. The campaign is clearly humorous and on some level campy, yet not far below the surface, there's also a real affinity for the Blockbuster brand that goes beyond mere nostalgia and gets to the question of whether streaming has really made our lives better or if certain elements of the old way of renting movies actually brought us closer. Anybody remember having that DVD, renting it out maybe, sitting around with the family or friends and watching that? You're not jumping around in different shows or have 1,500 choices right now. You're watching the DVD with family or friends, eating popcorn. Does that resonate with any? Okay, streaming today, that's not really the way life is. So is there any nostalgia for that among a certain segment of the population? Everything comes and goes, and people really miss the times when a Friday movie night was a true family moment. Everyone had to decide together what to watch. And once you picked your movie, you stuck with it. There was no regret, no watching 5 minutes and then moving on to something else. No multiple people on the same couch watching different things on their devices, being completely disconnected from one another. So this is how a brand can stay around when in decline. They added a lot of people miss that way of living, and that's why the world's last Blockbuster is becoming such a popular and beloved story. We want to keep that story going, says the ad agency. So that's sort of a fun thing that's pop culture, I think, today in marketing. This relates over to a bit of international global marketing we've been talking about. Kellogg Company splits its business with the launch of Kellanova to house global snacking brands. Kellogg Company is now operating as two separate entities under the names Kellogg and Kellanova, following a spinoff of North American cereal business from the overall company earlier in the year. The two distinct identities, one of which pays tribute to the company's heritage, Kellogg, and the other is forward-facing, Kellanova. What's Nova mean in, what is it, Greek? Nova? New? So we're saying new Kellogg and the existing Kellogg is what they're playing with in terms of branding, brand names. So Kellogg pays tribute to the company's heritage. The other is forward-facing, reflecting their different approaches to brand building. So we're seeing corporate strategies. As a result of the split, many iconic non-cereal U.S. brands, including Pringles, Pop-Tarts, and Nutri-Grain, will now sit under the Kellanova banner. That brand will also steward a range of international cereal brands, including Frosties, Special K, and Cocoa Pops, among others. So we're seeing their global marketing strategy under this new plan. Meanwhile, W.K. Kellogg Company will operate in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean, taking ownership for cereal brands, including Frosted Flakes, Special K, Raisin Bran, Rice Krispies, and Corn Flakes. So again, their corporate marketing strategy and what they're doing with what once was separate countries under their banner. We'll talk about that in just a second. The Kellogg brand isn't going anywhere, though. Consumers will continue to see Kellogg's branding on product packaging around the world, but it will be shared now by both W.K. Kellogg and Kellanova, which now operate as independent companies. So their global marketing approach. I cut this down, but this was in the news as I was looking for stuff for today. Their CEO talking about this, I think CEO talking about this plan. Let's see how this plays out for us.
And here with us at Post 9 in a first on CNBC interview is W.K. Kellogg CEO Gary Pilnick. He joins us after ringing the opening bell. He brought his friends, a lot of characters here from serials we know. Gary, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you're getting rid of Pringles and Pop-Tarts and just focusing on cereal. What is that going to allow you to do?
That's going to allow us to become an even stronger company because we're independent. At the end of the day, everything we're going to do is in service of cereal. We have a strategy to create great value, and none of this, well, the key pillars of what we're doing would have been done but for the spin, because now we get to make decisions that have a singular focus on what is the very best way to invest in and drive the cereal category for the W.K. Kellogg Company.
What does that mean? Does that mean more acquisitions? Does it mean more innovations?
It means a couple different things. I'd say, let me raise three of them for you. First of all, it's actually a combination of five separate businesses. At the Kellogg Company, we had a business in the Caribbean, Canada, food away from home that was scaled up across seven different categories. Bear Naked and Kashi were run separately, and then U.S. retail. All of that's going to come together. Think about the opportunity to harmonize across the business, but also scale up big ideas. And we get all the consumer, customer insights under one leader who can then drive the business accordingly. Another place we go to is for focus. Before at the Kellogg Company, we have a great sales force. It's well known within the industry, and it sells several different categories. Our sales force will have the same coverage. They're only selling cereal. So in the moment of truth, our cereal salespeople, they're going to understand that category as well, if not better than everybody, to help convert shoppers into buyers. The last thing I'll go to is our ability to invest and use our balance sheet the way we want to use our balance sheet. We want to invest $450 to $500 million to modernize our supply chain. Now, that's the centerpiece to our plan to drive expanded margin. It should also help our top line as well.
And so if you're attuned, given what we talked about before, to listening to what he had to say, it's going to be interesting to see whether this plays out as a true international firm or global brand. It sounds like they're pooling all this stuff together, and they're going to get economies of scale, things we've talked about, at the top end, with consumer input at the bottom end. So I don't know if they're going to have a glocalization approach, be global where they can and local where they have to, or whether they'll have more of a approach that have a lot of consumer-driven things at the various countries they were talking about. But it's exactly on target with what we've been talking about in the class about how to do international business, yeah? All right, page 106 of the induction notes, chapter 7, page 197 in the textbook. And we have been talking about understanding the difficulty in understanding cultural differences as we go internationally. We ended up with this example from a pretty good company, Nike, who thought they were doing a cool thing by borrowing these Samoan tatals. And, of course, they were unfortunately exploiting a culture they hadn't asked the right questions. So it's the significance of not understanding what the culture means that you're about to work with, appropriate, apply, appeal to. Let's do a continuation of the global environmental scan. Let's look at the economic environment as we make our decisions. What is the infrastructure like? The country's ability to provide communications, transportation, and energy. Anybody know enough about Mother Russia to tell me about how many time zones Mother Russia has? How many? 14, I was going to say 11 because I didn't look it up, but 14. It is massive. How many do we have? Yeah, continental. Four, they have between 11 and 14 time zones. Imagine what it must be like to run a business there. Imagine what it might mean to get your channel of distribution out across those time zones. Forget about getting product back the way we do Amazon returns. How would that work there? What's the infrastructure in the country look like that you're trying to do work in? Communication, transportation, energy. Level of economic development is a general indicator of the market's attractiveness and an indicator of the kind of products that will be demanded. In the US, if we were to draw a little fancy diagram, we might see it very narrow at the top, where we have the top 1 or 2% who are fantastically wealthy, but there's not a lot of them. We might then see sort of a bulk where we have the middle class folk. And then we might have a smaller end where people are truly, truly poor. You can shift that how you want to. That implies that there's going to be a lot of demand, well, a small demand for yachts, jet airplanes, polo ponies. Then there's going to be a lot of things for underarm deodorant, air conditioners, TV sets, pick whatever other silly thing, cereal. And then down at the bottom is going to be a teeny group of folks that are just struggling. I'm not sure what you're marketing to them. Maybe social services and help. But other countries of the world, if you did a similar diagram, you might have a tall, thin thing up there with a little bunch of people at the top, and then everybody else is down here at the bottom. Not such a big demand for underarm deodorant, TV sets, etc. Maybe agricultural products to keep people alive. What does it look like in the country you're going into? What is their gross income per capita compared to your other choices, compared to your domestic situation? So here is the gross national income per capita. I was hoping it would tell me where we are. I guess that's in the world. Okay, that's the world. And then the question is, how would your particular country do in those terms? And so we can look across all of the different choices we would have and judge whether or not their gross national income per capita makes sense for us. The rate of economic growth. What's the rate of change in real gross domestic product? Here we see Japan, the US, the United Kingdom, and China. And we see that China through 2021 is doing pretty darn good in terms of the rate of change of real GDP compared to other choices. And the USA, especially in 2020, it looks like, really dipped down, and we've jumped back significantly. But in your particular time period, as you're looking across the countries, how's their economic growth rate look before you go jump into that country? Competition. Oftentimes, companies overlook local competition. Think back to our Ford Mustang example going into China. They have some stiff competitors who are agile, who are innovative, who are cost efficient. So what's the point? To be successful, you gotta have some differential advantage. You can't be, you have less technology, you're higher price, and your car doesn't go as far. Those are not really advantages. What's the differential advantage you have against local competition that's gonna make you succeed? Political stability, you don't wanna have a big investment in a country that's about to fall apart, so you risk losses. And now let's return for a moment to Mother Russia. Prior to this most recent unfortunate, is it a political incident? What would you call the situation we have between Russia and the rest of the world? The largest McDonald's in the world, I believe, was in downtown Moscow. Wildly big, wildly popular, and they had many, many more sites. What's happened since all of this? All that business is shut down, gone away. All that investment, they got something back, is gone. Now again, hard to foresee that, but still, you want to, as best you can, think about the political stability of the country you're going into, lest you walk into problems. Here's a political stability index from the globaleconomy.com. Very stable, okay? Liechtenstein, Andorra, Singapore, Aruba. Who's been to Aruba? Nice place. Aruba. The U.S. is fortunately not on the bottom part of the scale, but let's jump down towards the bottom. We've got Mali, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Somalia. Probably not good places to do major investment. You probably knew that yourself. But still, what's it look like for the country you're talking about going into? This is just, again, helping us to visualize the world. The places that are more red and orange are more unstable. The places more towards green and blue are more stable. You'd want to think about these things as you were investing. We talk in here over time, when I think about it, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And sometimes we talk about social responsibility and how does it fit in. So here's how countries are progressing towards the UN Sustainable Development Goals. 100% would be all goals achieved. Nobody is there, but near the top, Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway. Estonia is doing okay. Switzerland is doing okay. The U.S. is 41st, behind Cuba, but ahead of Bulgaria. So if that was an important factor in your corporate strategy, how would these countries you think about going into look in terms of the Sustainable Development Goals of the U.N.? How are you going to enter the country? You've done your research, you've decided you want to get involved, but there's a bunch of different ways you could get involved. What's going to make the most sense for you? Interestingly, a very low level of involvement happens sometimes when somebody else takes your product, sells it somewhere, and the first you hear that you're actually exporting is when somebody calls up for some kind of service or warranty, and you say, wait a minute, I don't sell in Switzerland. I don't know what you're talking about. That's truly the extreme of low involvement, low risk, indirect exporting. Okay? It does literally happen that way sometimes. You suddenly find out somebody's doing it for you. More direct exporting might be you just set up somebody in the corner office with a phone or a computer, and you have them try to do export sales to France and just see how that goes. Low risk, low involvement. Not a lot of reward, huge reward, but still. So it would be a low level of involvement. A middle level would be some form of licensing. So you are going to share information about your manufacturing, say, with companies there, and contract them to do manufacturing for you. You are, of course, running some risk there. You're sharing your manufacturing secrets. You're sharing your processes. And you're saying, you're going to work for me under that situation. Contract assembly. Franchising is a form of licensing, right? So all those McDonald's stores, we're going to see later on. We are going to see. We're going to see McDonald's in China, Kentucky Fried Chicken in Japan, we talked about. Franchising. A joint venture. Now you find a company, a partner on the other in the other side of the world, in the other country. You guys are going to work together, share stuff, try to achieve joint corporate goals. Sort of that example of Nestle's and General Mills working together to market cereal from last time in the UK. Direct investment, obviously expensive. You're going to build your plant with your, hire your people, run your shop in that foreign country. More risk involved, more reward possible. So laying these out, we see exporting directly or import-export middleman, low involvement, low risk, low control, low profitability. Company sales branches in another country, licensing foreign producers, contract manufacturing, joint ventures, strategic alliances, wholly owned subsidiaries, and out to being a multinational corporation where you have high involvement abroad, high risk, high control, and high profit potential. Lots of examples across here. For example, we already talked about the fact that Ohio is one of the top exporting states in the country, and they want companies to be involved in import-export business. And so they have information for you out there. How strong are we in terms of being exporter? How do we rank as an importer? What's our total balance rank? And how can you join in terms of getting involved in exporting? Is information out there for them. And they offer up specific services for you, if that's what you want to get involved in. So here's the Export Assistance and International Engagement webpage from the Department of Development. Exporting can be sort of strange sorts of things. A while ago, I was over at the, I think it was the Sheraton Suites over in Cuyahoga Falls by the river, and they were doing an export sort of thing for the state. I'm talking to this company there out of Medina, Ohio. Who's Medina? Medina, Ohio. This company, a few years ago, garage door manufacturer. I said, you're a garage door manufacturer. What are you doing here at an export show? He said he doesn't exactly know why, but those doors that he manufactured were in great demand in Europe. He exports garage doors to Europe. Not the thing that springs to mind, but apparently there was a business opportunity for him there. You never know. So they were doing a nice business overseas. Coca-Cola does licensing or contract manufacturing by foreign producers. You can't share Coca-Cola's secret with anybody. They have their secret recipe. And you can't also be making Coke and Pepsi in the same place. You have a contract with them. So a middle ground in terms of involvement. Joint ventures like General Motors. We talked before, last time, about them having a joint venture in China. General Motors is a global company committed to delivering safer, better, and more sustainable ways for people to get around. GM, its subsidiaries, and its joint ventures entities sell vehicles under the Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, Cadillac, Beijing, and Wuling brands. More information on the company and its subsidiaries, including OnStar, a global leader in vehicle safety and safety surfaces, can be found at that website. GM and its joint ventures in China have more than 58,000 employees. GM, along with its joint ventures, offer the broadest lineup of vehicles and brands among automakers in China. Products are sold under those nameplates. So they've gone a joint venture route. And then we have the idea of a multinational corporation. They've got shops in many countries. They have high involvement with lots of employees, manufacturing in many countries. Anybody know the name Saint-Gobain? Have you seen that image anywhere around? Yeah, they were actually there. One of their companies was there yesterday at the, anybody else go to the marketing, sales and marketing career fair yesterday, other than my friend up front here? Just one? Oh, you guys, was that cool? Had you been to one before? That was pretty slick. 45, 50 employers, 170 students. You know, you guys sales oriented? No? Say again, marketing oriented? Okay, yeah, it was pretty good. Did you make some good contacts? Yeah, so those career fairs are well worthwhile. All right, so let's look at a little more detail on some of these examples. Coca-Cola, they're involved in licensing and contract manufacturing by foreign producers. Where are they based? Well, not Ohio. Atlanta, Georgia. They operate in 200 companies. They use 300 bottling partners with exclusive rights. Again, you can't be selling Pepsi as well. And they have to deal with 50 different currencies. So they have a lot of interesting money exchange things going on. As an example, this is from a while ago. Domestic economic problems in the last recession meant the U.S. dollar was weaker in the world. The dollar lost 3.4% against the euro in that year. They lost 1% against the Japanese yen. So U.S. consumers had to pay more for imported goods. And if you have to pay more for imported goods in that time period, it's going to reduce imports, an issue, a problem for some companies, some consumers. But for Coke, they had weaknesses in some currencies. Those were offset by strengths in others. Where's my finance people? Okay, so they have a bunch of people sitting in that back room watching currency exchanges and engaging in currency exchange over time, each day, making sure that they're getting the best financial deal out of the difference in currency exchange rates. So in the second quarter of that year, Coke reported a 20% increase in income, and 11% of that increase in income was due to exchange rates. So being a global company spreads your risk and gives you the opportunity to have increased income across currencies. So what am I talking about here? Well, the currency exchange rate is the price of one country's currency expressed in terms of another country's currency. Finance people know that. Everybody else may too. I don't know. A higher valued currency makes a country's imports less expensive and its exports more expensive in foreign markets. So if we're a global marketer, we certainly have to be aware of the exchange rate in different countries that we're working with. Most currency exchange rates do fluctuate due to changes in supply and demand for the currencies, differences in the interest rates in the two countries. Right now, what's in general going on in the interest rates in the U.S.? What are they generally doing? Going up or down? Interest rates, U.S. Ah, they're going up, making the dollar stronger against other countries' currencies, meaning, of course, that it's more expensive to buy our product overseas. The country's overall economic strength and performance, political stability, and each country's balance of trade. So those guys in the back office from finance are watching over those currency exchange rates and making sure that they're getting the best deal on a daily basis. The currency exchange rate affects trade and the movement of money between currencies. Companies like Coke, with strong financial capabilities, can engage in what I'm just talking about, currency exchanging, financial arbitrage, to profit from exchange rate differences. This strategy involves buying currencies when they're weak, selling them when they're stronger, and trying to generate additional revenue, which they're successful at, from these transactions. So as a global company, Coke has distributed its risks throughout the world. Our point exactly. Global strategic alliances are typically set up when a business desires to edge into a related business or new geographic market. If an organization doesn't have the capability to do what they want to do in coping with their global environment, they should think about a global business partnership. Setting up business in China on your own from scratch, given, well, you do know it's still a communist country, given the rules, the regulations, the intricacies, you're just not going to succeed. They aren't going to let you come in and engage in a freestanding business enterprise. You've got to go through some sort of strategic alliance or joint venture. SAIC, General Motors Corporation, is a joint venture between GM and SAIC Motor that manufactures and sells Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, and other brands in mainland China. Sangoman. Sangoman is a multinational corporation. They have more than 1,000 companies across 54 different countries. They're listed on stock markets in Paris, London, Frankfurt, Zurich, Brussels, Amsterdam. They're massively big. And right around here, even though you don't recognize their logo or their name. They have a workforce of over 207,000 people. And they're one of the world's 100 leading industrial corporations. They have a portfolio focused on glass, ceramics, plastics, cast iron. They transform raw materials into advanced products for use in our daily lives, as well as developing tomorrow's new materials. So they have a shop in Solon, in Ravenna, in Hiram. Who knew? It's a fun story for me to tell. I've mentioned before I took students to Europe, international trips for a decade or more. One time we were lucky enough to be at Saint-Gobain corporate headquarters in La Défense, France, their version of Manhattan, I guess. And I'm chatting and the global HR woman comes and says, "Where are you from again?" I said, "Well, Kent State University, Kent, Ohio." She says, "I was just there." "Excuse me, what were you doing in Kent, Ohio?" She was at one of these plants over here. She was a new HR president, vice president, whatever you are. And she was doing exploration of all their different businesses. And she was just in the Kent area because she was visiting some of their plants. It's a small world. They also were in different places in Pennsylvania, Macedonia, Ohio, Muncie, Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky, Aurora, and Massachusetts. Yeah, so they're all over the place here. And they're also in 53 other countries. How are we going to work with our marketing mix elements in this foreign country that we're going to enter? Well, one approach we take is called product extension. In this case, we're just going to sell whatever we sell the way we sell it. The product will be the same. It might work well for steel. I'm not sure if it works well for hamburgers. Tastes differ. Product adaptation or modification is where we change the product to match the customer's differing needs, wants, desires in that country. So that's a separate approach. Or sometimes we actually have to come up with an entirely new product that we haven't offered before in order to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires that are not being met by any current product. In a little bit, when we get to our story here about McDonald's in China, we'll see they did some product extension. And man, they did some interesting product invention. See what you think about what you hear about the hamburger they came up with. Oh, here it is. So this is inside the McDonald's empire in China. And it'll play on some of these ideas that we will see. And then we'll move to other elements of the marketing mix.
Inside the McDonald's empire.
Same hamburgers, same fries, same drinks. You might think you're in Dallas or Detroit, but this is China. 2 decades ago, McDonald's was largely unknown here, except as a symbol of the decadent West. But a capitalist revolution has swept through the People's Republic. And today, mainland China, still officially communist, is home to 800 McDonald's restaurants, with 200 more in Hong Kong.
And Mojoshiwan means I'm loving it.
Jeff Schwartz is loving it too. He's CEO of McDonald's China.
When you look at the map, can you imagine how many stores might be in China one day?
I don't need to look at the map to imagine that. I just look at the 1.3 billion population. You know, easily we're talking 10,000 restaurants, 15,000 restaurants as it continues to develop. So the opportunity is endless.
Endless, but not effortless. That's why Schwartz and his boss, Tim Fenton, spend so much time in China, on the road, in the air, and on the move.
3 weeks out of four.
Fenton is president of McDonald's for Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. There's no one at McDonald's with more experience moving into new markets.
Mistakes we've made in the past, you don't open just one store. You get three or four or five deals done, build them consecutively, train the crew consecutively, so you save on the money. So when a truck goes out from the distribution center, it's not carrying one store, it's carrying the products for 3 to 5.
When McDonald's first opened in China in 1990, these streets were clogged with bicycles. But prosperity's brought an explosion in car ownership. However many headaches that may mean for Chinese drivers, McDonald's saw an opportunity called drive-thru.
Well, this is the very first drive-thru we opened in November of 2005. So it's been about 18 months. Very, very successful.
First drive-thru, not just for the company.
For anywhere in China. So anywhere at all in China. So drive-thru was a brand new concept anywhere in China.
In fact, drive-thru was such a new concept in 2005 that many Chinese didn't know how to use it.
We have a lot of traffic, and I'm walking around, they pick up the food, and then they went in the... And then they went in and parked their car, they brought the bag of food, and they went inside. And I watched this happen several times, and I said, I think we might have a problem here on how the Chinese use the drive-thru.
Which meant that Chinese crews not only had to learn how to run a drive-thru, but had to teach their customers how to use one.
They're very good about holding their hands out, and, you know, stop here. Is this something that you train your crew?
You train her crew to greet customer with the hand out of the window. This way they will train their customer how to use drive-thru.
But still, some customers don't catch on as fast as others.
Well, he's coming in the exit side.
Yeah.
He's BMW here. That's part of the training sometimes about with a drive-thru.
Yeah.
McDonald's is up to 26 drive-thrus in China so far. But if most Chinese drivers still aren't familiar with the idea, that's about to change dramatically. In 2006, McDonald's signed an agreement with the Chinese state oil company, Sinopec, granting it the right to open McDonald's stores at any of Sinopec's new and existing gas stations, 30,000 of them. The very first one, opened in July of 2006, is this store. In a surprisingly run-down neighborhood outside Beijing.
Obviously, it's on the fringe, okay? It's off the beaten path of main, you know, Beijing. So it's a suburb coming out.
It's a little grittier.
Yeah, it's a little grittier, but it's like an oasis to me. I'm guessing we might be a little premature here.
Yeah.
From the McDonald's side,
yeah.
But with only upside potential.
Yeah.
That, in a nutshell, has become a key part of McDonald's expansion strategy in China. The willingness to bet on an area that may not be ready for a McDonald's yet. But with China the world's fastest growing economy, McDonald's is banking on neighborhoods like this being a good gamble.
It's really not that difficult. You look at a developing area, you see where it's going. You see the corners, you see the retail, you see the apartments and the condos coming in.
You can spot an up-and-comer.
Yeah, we've done a lot of real estate. we've done it like 34,000 times.
Tell me about what this neighborhood looked like before this store was built.
Nothing was around. These buildings right here were half built, and there was nothing behind there. But you looked at the site layout, and they said, well, the shopping mall's going here. There's going to be, you know, 5,000 residents here, and down the street here will be another 5,000 residents. It was amazing.
But for all of China's potential, the learning curve for McDonald's here has been steep, and they've had to play catch-up. When McDonald's opened its first mainland store in 1990, rival KFC had already been there for 3 years. Today, there are more than 1,900 KFC stores in China, more than twice as many as the Golden Arches.
McDonald's has a lot of competition here in China, not all of it from big-name U.S. brands like KFC. You can find mom-and-pop food stands like these all over the country. And although dishes like scorpions and seahorses on a stick may not be your idea of a meal, here they're traditional, they're convenient, and they're cheap.
A short walk through any Chinese city reveals a kaleidoscopic array of foods, tastes, and textures. Adapting the McDonald's menu to palates used to foods like these is the job of McDonald's corporate chef, Leslie Bailey.
Now, this is the value pork burger.
He spends his days in a Hong Kong food lab that McDonald's calls the Forbidden Kitchen.
We're going to test this in 40 stores.
This has a good picture of it.
What makes it hot? Is it the sauce or even the patty?
No, the patty itself. It's seasoned with Sichuan pepper.
That is good.
Yeah?
That is a good sandwich.
That's a cucumber.
Wow.
Taste, convenience, and price are important in China, just like in the U.S. But the issue here that trumps them all is food safety. It is a nightmarish problem in a developing country where corruption is rampant and safe food handling practices are still largely unknown.
How much do you live in fear of waking up some morning and seeing a headline about McDonald's food safety being called into question?
I don't live in fear of it. It's always in the back of your mind, something because of the area we live in, particularly of the history that this part of the world has had with avian influenza and SARS.
Food safety concerns are one reason all Chinese McDonald's stores have hand washing stations and hand sanitizers right out in the main restaurant. And behind the scenes, McDonald's says its stores and its Chinese suppliers, like this bun factory near Beijing, meet the same standards as those in the U.S.
So we see some interesting things here. First of all, we don't think today sanitizers in stores are anything big, a big deal, but this is years ago that they had it there for food safety issues. Then we see, yeah, you can get a regular McDonald's hamburger. That's just moving the same product along. How about a Szechuan burger with cucumber? That's not something that most of us go to the local McDonald's and order up. And I don't know if it actually caught on, but they were doing brand new innovations. Cultural differences. Who would have thought, would you have thought that the Chinese don't know how to use a drive-through? Of course you put in a drive-through. They'll know, nope, they didn't know how to do that. What aren't you expecting to happen in this country that you're going into as you try to make things work? So that was one day I have to look up, or maybe during class one time I'll look up and see how many current stores they've moved to since this film was done. But it gives you a sense of going global, yeah. promotional strategies. You can use the same promotion globally, or you can adapt your promotion to local tastes. When Kentucky Fried Chicken first went into Japan, they were not attuned to the fact that the Japanese consumer likes to see the food you can get before they order it. Have you ever been to a Chinese fancy Chinese restaurant? They actually show you sort of models in a case of what you can buy. Have you ever seen that? That's a common thing in Japan. So oddly, in order to promote their product, they had to find a, and there were such manufacturers of, mock-ups of every product they make. And so you go to the local food mock-upper, you get rubber or plastic models made, all painted up, and you put them outside your store to promote your store. Then by accident, they discovered that the colonel himself really had huge appeal in Japan. So they found in a bunch of old warehouses things of the colonel, statues of the colonel, as if he became an icon in each of the stores in Japan. And to this day, in Japan, going to Kentucky Fried Chicken for your birthday, a holiday celebration, is really a big special deal. Much more so than here, cultural differences. Anyhow, do you need to adapt your promotion, make that food product? This is an ad I don't think you'd see here in the States, where we're focusing on kids.
Tomato McGrand, I'm loving it. Debut.
Ronald McDonald was a little sexier in Japan, I guess. Create entirely new promotions as appropriate for that particular country of the world. So if we look at these product and promotion ideas, you can merge them together. If you're selling the same product and the same promotion, you have a product extension strategy. If you're using the same product and adapting your promotion, you have a communication adaption strategy. If you are adapting your product using the same promotional approach, then you have a product adaptation strategy. And if you're adapting both, you have a dual adaptation strategy. And then if you create a new product, obviously you can't use the same promotion, it's new. So you have a product invention strategy. What works for you in that country? I don't know. That's what you need your marketers to tell you. Then you run into other sorts of things to think about. Your channels of distribution compared to what you're used to are going to be unusually long. They're going to be complex. How are you getting those products to where they need to be? You saw the example of McDonald's. Of all people learning the lesson, you don't build one store and then try to stock one store and train people in one store at a time. There's no economies of scale there, man. What must it cost to move a hamburger in a big truck? I mean, come on. So now you do four or five things. Your channel of distribution makes more sense. You're able to save money there. Countries may impose pricing constraints. You have to know about that as you get out into that country. Timken ran, they're pretty smart. They ran into some interesting issues related to marketing, sales, and pricing.
We tend to hire locals. And if, you know, our business in China, we're hiring China citizens. And so they understand the culture pretty well. Our marketing communications people are Chinese. So we tend to do pretty well, I think, in terms of promotion and marketing. The one example, though, I thought of was in pricing. Because one of the things that happened over the last 3 or 4 years is certain lines of our products, we had more demand in the marketplace than we could produce. And that's a nice problem to have, although you have upset customers that can't get enough product. And so we actually were talking to our sales organization about the importance of pricing. You know, you're in an environment where there's not enough product to go around. There are some customers willing to pay more to get more product. And so this pricing discussion was very important. And so with our raw material cost increases we've seen in steel and energy and all those kinds of things, price increases have been a big topic. We have to do it to survive. And we're also in the situation where demand exceeds supply for some products. And so one of the things we encountered in China is we had some salespeople that were very hesitant to do that. And I think in some of the Asian cultures, to go to a customer and communicate to them a price increase was losing face. And we didn't understand that when we talked to our sales team about that, and the feedback started to come back. And so we had to kind of go back a second time and just have an open discussion about why this was so important and how to communicate it to the customer in a way where you didn't lose face with the customer, that the customer can understand this is something we have to do so that we can continue to service you with high quality products and services. So that was an interesting one that happened in China.
In the U.S., we don't have such a big deal about the status of the salesperson versus the status of the client. I mean, I don't think that that's something that comes into our minds. It's a business deal. We have a contract. Things are all set. In many Asian countries, in China in particular, you have the idea of status, and you tend to do business with people that you see as being of equal status. And you, it's part of that status, you have face, you have an equivalency of respect. And they did not, coming from America, where people change prices all the time, see this deal, that going back to somebody that you have equal status with and saying, hey, dude, I got to rescind my pricing offer and give you a new price, was a loss of respect, a loss of face. And they had to rethink that and retrain folks and talk about, with their sales force, how to make that happen in a way that made sense in that country. Not a big deal here, bigger deal there. If you want to know more, we have an international business for business majors, international business for business majors. We have a minor, is what I'm trying to say. We have international business for non-business majors, or you can just take a course or two in international business or international marketing, or here's a training video if you want to be involved in import and export as a business. All right, so we thought about all of the importance about understanding B2C consumers, B2B consumers. We thought about the importance of going global and how much research has to go in to each one of these situations, understanding ultimate consumers, business consumers, the country we're going into. So to make this happen, we obviously have to engage in some form of marketing research. So we talk about that in Chapter 8, from consumer insights, or if you like, country insights, to action. So lecture notes page, I assume I'm right when I say 115. So we have to know what's going on in the external world, the factors outside of ourselves. And these, as you recall, are the CREST factors. Anybody recall what C was of the external factors? Competition. Thank you. Are you reading it off the page or something? How about R? Regulatory, legal, and political. E, economic. S, social. And T, technology. Is it right on the page? You're just reading it off there. So those are factors that we have to track on. And what are we tracking on them to do? We're asking what is going to happen with these things in the future, hard enough to do, and what's it going to mean for our consumers? So we're also tracking on the issue of consumers as well. So competition, CR is competition, regulatory, economic, social, and technology changes, but with the consumer at the middle, B2B consumer, an industrial consumer, B2C, the final consumer. What does it mean to them, and what will it mean for our marketing mix, our product place, and promotion? Research is the way we're going to get those answers. If we're looking at our strategic marketing management framework, which we haven't seen for a while, we're thinking about all those external factors, monitoring competition, regulations, economic, social, and technology changes, and the impact on the B2B or the B2C consumer. That's going to drive stuff for our marketing objectives, our marketing strategy, and our marketing mix. So what is marketing research? Well, it's the process of defining a marketing problem. You don't do research just to do research. And opportunity. And systematically collecting and analyzing information, and then recommending actions. Again, we're not just collecting data to collect data. We have to keep in mind, 100%, I would agree, research is imperfect. It's not a perfect world. We can't forecast things with certainty. It's called a forecast. We can't predict consumer behavior with certainty. But if my job and my company and my brand are at stake, sure, I can use some of my personal experience and expertise, but I also would like a little research too. So research is going to help us to make these decisions. Alex Schaefer, the senior manager of consumer insights at Dollar Shave Club. You guys know Dollar Shave Club? Is that a brand you know? Works with Prodigy. We've heard from the sales guy at Prodigy. We've seen him before. We'll see him again. to do marketing research. The research guides product innovation, communication strategies, and brand positioning through insights that ensure the consumer is at the center of business decision making. Yes, consumer at the center research gives us insights. Alex's passion for research stems from an interest in uncovering human motivations. We talked about the importance of human motivations. He says at its core, research is about understanding people. Yes, on a human level, why they do what they do, how they feel when they do certain things, and from a business perspective, how a brand or a product can play a meaningful role in their lives. Furthermore, what research reminds me to do on a daily basis is to practice empathy. While we all practice empathy daily, I love that it's a crucial part of my work, and that the more I empathize with the people I'm talking to or surveying, my consumers, and by the way, you could also say your employees, the better insights I'm able to deliver. The most successful and impactful research I've done has helped decision makers put themselves in the shoes of the consumers and build strategy from that point. So we have Protege working with Daughter Club in terms of important decision making driven by research. So what does this mean? Well, marketing research then is used for planning our marketing programs based on the insights we got about those external factors, about the consumer, their needs, wants, desires, how they feel, their attitudes. It's used in the implementation of the programs, putting together that marketing mix, that advertising campaign, and evaluating how well they did. How do you know? Did your product sell in the right stores at the right prices to the right people? Did your ads generate the right attitude, generate the right feelings, inform people in the right way? Well, if you're not doing any research, you got nothing. So marketing researchers are the ones that are responsible for collecting and interpreting data that supports this decision making. Now, as I said, market research is imperfect. Marketers are imperfect. Mistakes are made. And so sometimes people poo-poo the importance of research. I already told you it's imperfect. I admitted that. It's not like it's a surprise. Can't always be perfect. One example of that was the disaster for Coke of their original idea for New Coke. It's an old story, but it still is an interesting one, where Coke and Pepsi are battling together, and research is showing that people are beginning to prefer Pepsi. It was less sweet, it was different fizziness, whatever the carbonation, whatever it was. So Coke does research. They're concerned they're losing market share to Pepsi, can't have that. They decide they're going to come up with a new competitive product, New Coke, and it's going to taste more like Pepsi-ish. Blind taste test, people like the new taste, they don't know it's a new Coke, tastes fine to them, they like it. So they're running a campaign, they're going to kill off classic Coke, there's only going to be New Coke. People went bonkers. They were pounding on the corporate gates. There was rioting in the streets in the day people cared about their Coke. And what the researchers didn't catch on to was it's not just the taste of the product when it comes to Coke. It's a whole cultural nostalgia experience of feeling in America about what Coke is. They canceled the idea for getting rid of classic Coke. Crystal Pepsi. This was the idea of why have color in your soda? Why not have it be clear, pristine, like water? Somebody actually found, periodically they bring these products back for fun. Somebody actually got me a bottle of this Crystal Coke. You pick it up, it looks like water, and you're about to drink it. I mean, in your mind, you know it's Pepsi, but when you suddenly get that clear thing in your mind, and it's Pepsi, it's like, what am I doing? What's happening? Nobody needed a clear Pepsi. It was not a good idea. It went away. Starbucks partnered with Pepsi to sell Mazza Grande, a coffee-flavored bottled soda. It was a spectacular failure, described as tasting interesting at best. They didn't figure that one out first before they bit, but okay, fine, all right. And finally, it's just strange things that you would think marketers would have figured out. What do we think when we think Colgate? Toothpaste. You can almost taste it on your tongue. How about some nice toothpaste? Kitchen dinners or kitchen entrees. What? What? So sometimes silly things happen, and then people say, well, why do you do research? Well, because people make mistakes. I still would rather have research behind me. So there's a five-step approach to doing marketing research for better marketing actions. First of all, you got to know what you're doing. Why are you doing the research? What's the problem? So you want to set the objectives of the research. What are the specific measurable goals for research and for the decision maker? Why are you doing this research? Sometimes people forget to ask that question. Some possible objectives. Well, to understand the issues better. This is called exploratory research. I don't know what's going on with my soup, my steel, my clothing line. I don't know. I better do some sort of exploratory research to better understand consumers' reactions because I don't know what's going on.
REI sells into two channels, brick and mortar primarily, about 150 stores, as well as digital. And I'd say the majority of our sales today are through the retail channel, but digital is becoming significantly more important. My team's responsibility looks across the entire co-op from a customer point of view. So we'll look at the marketing spend, we'll look at the digital channel, we'll look at the retail channel, operations, but all from a customer perspective. We have an incredible amount of customer data at REI, given 90% of the transactions are made by members. A huge piece of how we're looking at that is to provide a more personal experience, especially on the website and as much as we can within the retail environment. One place where Tableau and the insights we've gotten from working with Tableau has really helped our business is in our direct and email channels, where we did a ton of work to segment our customers. Those insights directly drove how we structured our email programs and our direct mail programs, and we've seen upwards of 20% improvements in specific mailings in both of those channels. Particularly profound and an important piece of Tableau for us is exploratory analysis. One of the critical pieces that we've discovered through exploratory analysis is actually the depth and severity of channel shift in customers purchasing in our digital channel versus customers purchasing in our brick and mortar retail stores. For REI, it's obviously incredibly important for us to think about how we can leverage analytics as a competitive advantage to discover insights and provide a better customer experience. Tableau is incredibly, incredibly critical to everything we do every day.
So Tableau is a product that helps them do the research, different kinds. They do exploratory regions. Research is a shift in our consumers between in-store purchases and web purchases. What's going on? What are they thinking? What's happening? We don't know. Let's do some exploratory research to find out what's driving that. Understand how it's impacting our consumers and, of course, our stores and profit. So exploratory research to better understand issues. REI is a consumer's cooperative selling outdoor recreation products, both online and in bricks and retail mortar stores, and understanding this shift in consumers' shopping patterns, really important to them. They use data to provide a more personal experience. Tableau and data analysis help them to segment their market, and exploratory analysis help to reveal this details behind the consumer's channel shift from bricks and mortar to online, and in depth, not just there's a shift. What's going on? What's going on with the consumers? So it helps us to understand the issues better through exploratory research. Marketing research also can help us to understand the relationships better. What does happen when I change the color of my product, change the size, increase price, lower price, sell it online, sell it offline? What is going on in terms of that relationship? Or to determine how to affect an element of interest. This is causal research. How can I improve consumers' attitudes about my product? How can I make them see there's a difference between my brand and the competition? How can I make them more aware of my brand? What sorts of things can I do for this segment of the marketplace to make these things happen? With our objective firmly in mind, what are we trying to accomplish? We now can think about the research plan. Turns out, research just doesn't happen. Oh, really? Research takes time and money, and nobody has unlimited time and unlimited money. So what are constraints do you have in mind here? That's going to constrain your research plan. For a while, I was a market researcher for a major manufacturer of appliances that used to be in Mansfield, Ohio. It's now a big field because Tappan Appliances went away. But I was a market researcher for them at corporate headquarters. And occasionally, they'd be in a meeting, the executives, and they'd walk out and they'd say, we need to know the forecast for avocado gas stoves in the Southeast for next year. Okay, well, I can get that research underway and going and do some forecasting. When do you need it? Now. Well, that pretty much means I'm not going to do elaborate online research, running a bunch of regression analysis and coming up with some answer, right? I got to go and do the quickest and dirtiest thing I can do with the reports we have at hand, drives my research design. So how long do you have to do the work? How much is it going to cost? How much money can you spend? These things will help you decide on the research plan. Then what data are you going to need? In this silly example, but actually true, they were just willing to settle with some existing secondary data reports off of trade publications, best we could do for the moment. You might want something more in depth. So what do we need to know? Sometimes people come to me and they say, you do market research, how's it? Evaluate this questionnaire. How are these questions? I say, I can't do that. What do you mean you can't do that? Aren't you a market researcher? Aren't you a marketer? Yeah, but I don't know what your objectives are. I don't know what you need to know. Why are you asking this question? What do you hope to get out of it? What's your goal? What's your objectives? So what do you need to know for this research? Collecting data takes time and costs money. Why are you asking these questions? How are you going to collect the data? Are you going to engage in sampling of the population as opposed to trying to measure everybody out there in your situation? We have the idea of probability sampling versus non-probability sampling. So I give you an assignment. And I say, you know, I'd like you to go find out for me what our students at Kent State think about this two-day fall break. They like it, they don't like it, it's a good idea, it's relaxing, it's so whatever the questions are I want in mind. You say, okay, I can do that. You say, I'm going to go run a random sample. I'm going to go down here to Risman Plaza, and I'm going to go stand there at noon after break. I'll stand there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and I'll stop every fifth person that goes through, and I'll ask them what they think. Does that seem reasonable? Did you get the answer? Reasonable? Does that seem unreasonable? Seems like you'd have to choose one side or the other. A reasonable way to do research? Not especially reasonable way to do research. All right, here's the real question at hand. If you did that, would you be collecting a probability sample? Would you be collecting random sample? Or would you be collecting non-probability sample, and why? Anybody actually know the answer? And why? Yeah. It is non-probability, so he got that part right. Let's see if he knows why. And why? You're only sampling people that can make it to campus. How many of you guys are never in Risman Plaza at noon on any day of the week? Are you in the sample then? You're not. This is what we do, this kind of research all the time, but it's not a random sample. It's not a probability sample. The difference between the two is the ability to actually make informed statistical inferences. When they run political polls, they always say that this guy is ahead of the other guy 55% to 45% plus or minus 3 percentage points. They're able to say that and show you the bandwidth around which they have their certainty because they're running true probability samples. If you were to say to me, I will do your research for you on whether or not Kent State students do or don't like fall break, give me a list of all students shuffle the list alphabetically so they aren't in alphabetical order, and I'll choose every 10th one, although that's probably too many people, but okay. I'll choose every 100th one, and I'll contact them. That is a probability sample, and everyone in that population has a known and an equal probability of being selected. That gives you the ability to do statistical inferences, and sometimes that's important, more important in political polling than in finding out Kent State students' opinion about fall break. So you have to make the decision. How are you going to do your research? How much time? How much is that going to cost? Two types of data are available to us, secondary data and primary data, and you have to decide what's going to make sense for you. Secondary data is facts and figures already recorded before the project. So that's going to be information on a different group of people, a different time frame, a different product, a different part of the country. Why would you ever want to use secondary data? It's not developed for your project. Why would you ever want to use secondary data? See if you get anybody else to answer, and then I'll pick on you. Hold on. We did get it. Okay, I'm going to walk up here. Watch your cord. All right, we'll start here. The actual current data might be really hard to get to, might be very expensive to get to. Way cheaper to get current data because it already exists. It's in your reports. It's in trade journals. And so we might, you can't actually see black on orange, can you? Can you actually see that? You can't, huh? All right, so what you might do is use facts and figures already recorded, because it's the guy that wanted the stuff right outside the office right now, how to use secondary data to get him his information. It's recorded, it's available. So sometimes it's internal data, stuff inside the firm, your financial statements, your research reports, your files, your customer letters, sales calls, reports, customer lists, or things like the U.S. Census. How often do they collect the census? Every 10 years. So it's hardly ever going to be current, yet it still might give you valuable information. By the way, they used to take a year or two to roll it out. It's a little faster now that it's electronic. Trade association studies, magazines, business periodicals, and internet-based reports. It might get you started. It might be a good enough answer. It might show you the foundation on which you're going to build. It's sure faster and cheaper than primary data. Primary data are facts and figures you're collecting right now for the project at hand. You can do it by observing folk, watching people mechanically or in person, or you can do it through questionnaires, asking people stuff. I'm about out of time. I have more to say on this topic, but I don't want to hold you back from either your spring or your fall break. And so I suggest off you go. Have a good time. See you next week. Be safe.